Station number 13244, Mr. Harvey Burnett, Riddle 1.
Whereabouts were you born,
I
please?
was born in Birkenhead in Cheshire in March 1922.
What did your father do for a living?
My father there was a dentist, dental surgeons they call them nowadays, but then it was a dentist, in Hamilton Square, which was the main sector of Birkenhead, in the same house that he had been since 1900.
Did you go to school in
And
Birkenhead?
I started at a prep school in Prenton, which is just a little way out of Birkenhead. But as we left Birkenhead at the age of 7, I only just started there.
And how old were you when you finished your education?
Total education, 17.
So which other school did you go to?
Now, after leaving Birkenhead, which was just around the time of the 1929 Depression, my father got a job with the Ministry of Health in London, and we moved from Birkenhead down to Carshalton in Surrey. Carshalton was then a small village. It's now classed as a suburb, but it had two beautiful lakes and just on the edge of the countryside. And after arriving there, I went first of all to a preparatory school called Collingwood, and then to the Wallington Grammar School for Boys, which was in Croydon Road. And I stayed there until I was 17 years of age.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I had left school for about 6 weeks. I had a job with a firm called Yule Cato in the City of London as an office boy. And when war broke out, the local town hall begged for volunteers for messenger boys. Now, at school, I had been in the Scouts, Boy Scouts movement, and I got a hurried message from my old scoutmaster saying, "Whatever you do, come and join us. They want messenger boys." Because at the beginning of the war, there was a lot of panic. They didn't know what was going to happen. So I said to my firm, Yule Cato, "What do you think?" And they said, "Well, go and join them." So from about October 1939 until I joined the Navy, I spent as a messenger boy with the Air Raid Precautions, ARP, in Wallington and District. Just going round the Air Raid Warden stations, the first aid posts, the fire brigades, bases, and the heavy rescue bases, but purely and simply as a messenger boy.
Did you see much of the bombing in the
Y
Blitz?
yes, we had the first air raids on Croydon, because Croydon Airport was just close by. And the biggest one was on the small factory area just at the edge of Croydon Airport. And attending on that air raid was the first time in my life I had ever seen a dead body.
Can you describe what the bombing was like as you witnessed it?
I rather think they were stray bombs, because I think only about 5 fell. And I was at the time at a first aid post in Stafford Road in Wallington, and we heard the bombers come over and then saw big clouds of smoke arising, followed very quickly by the noise of an explosion. And very shortly afterwards, the notification was to send ambulances from the first aid post, and they asked me as a messenger to go along with them in case I was needed to bring back messages. This I did. We went down to this factory site, and the particular factory we went to had been a scent factory, making cosmetics, perfumes, and things like that. And the tanks that hold the cosmetic substances had been burst, and the smell was quite appalling. And that was one of the first thing we noticed. In fact, some of the people, thinking it was gas, put on their gas masks, but they were quickly told there's nothing dangerous in the atmosphere. And then when we went into it, the heavy rescue guided us to various places, and I saw underneath the machine some legs. And I thought, oh, we must get that fellow out. So I wasn't particularly useful, still being virtually a schoolboy. So I just stood by and watched, and it was the first time I'd ever seen somebody dead who was pulled from under the machine, covered in dust, debris, no blood. He hadn't been cut at all. I presume it had been a heavy blow to his head or something like that. But he was taken away in the ambulance. And then very shortly afterwards, they sent me back to the main depot to do any more messengering. And that was the only actual air raid I saw or was anything to do with.
What was the name of the factory?
It's very difficult to remember this stage. If I remember it later, I'll let you know. It was a scent factory.
Where was it?
In Wadden. Wadden is the edge of Croydon. And Croydon Airport had these factories all round the edge of it, which had been built up in the 1920s and 1930s. And the bombs fell on this. There was a scent factory. There was a hardwood factory, which used to make doors and fences and all sorts of things like that, and some engineering works. And various little factories around the place. But it was only the scent factory that I particularly went to.
When would this bombing have occurred, do you think?
This, I think, would be the beginning of 1940.
Beginning of 1941?
No, 1940. Because, the war started in 1939. Then the bombing started in 1940, did it not?
I think it started the summer of 1940.
But it will be about that, because I didn't join the Navy until 1941. So I was in ARP for quite a long time. It was a summer day, so it would possibly be the middle of 1940, something about that time. But it was the first air raid on Croydon. And it was a daytime raid.
Did you see any other bombing?
Not in England.
What really did this ARP work as a messenger boy entail? What really did you have to do?
What I really had to do, I had a motorcycle, not a bicycle, a motorcycle, and it was just literally a question of going round the depots with messages, because there were no fax in those days, so virtually every telephone call had to be followed by a written instruction. And if the town hall, which was the main point for instructions, sent a message to a first aid post or a warden's post, they would phone it through, then a typist would type it out or write it in longhand, give it to the messenger boy, and he would have to take it, get it signed for, and bring the signed receipt back. Bureaucracy was taking place even then. All the copies had to be filed and taken literally by hand. And that was basically my messenger. We were 24 hours on and 24 hours off. And I kept my motorbike at home, because if I was wanted, they only had to ring up home and I'd be out even on the day off.
So you're a bit like what the army calls a dispatch rider.
It was a virtually dispatch rider.
How did public morale stand up to the bombing, as far as you observed?
Now, I've been asked that once or twice, and I think the simplest thing is in one word, and it was indignation. It wasn't fear, it wasn't panic. It was indignant that our little area of England should be molested. It was fury at the Germans. Of course, this was very early on in the war. Before the night raids and things had really started. And it was before the advent of the Battle of Britain, which was August 40, wasn't it? August 1940.
Yes.
I'm still trying to think of the name of the scent factory. I'll bring it out later on.
It doesn't matter. How did you come to be in the Navy?
Well, I had a friend, many friends at school, and I was chatting to him one day, and he was saying, you know, we're getting on to 18 now. We're going to be called up. I don't want to go in the army, and I'm sure you don't want to go in the army. What about going to the recruiting centre in Croydon, close by, and see if we can join the Navy? Now, he knew I'd always been interested in ships, and having come from Birkenhead, which is Merseyside, was a shipping area. So, literally, we got on our bicycles, we went over to Croydon, and went into the Naval Recruiting Office in Croydon, and were welcomed with open arms by a very fat, very friendly Navy Chief Petty Officer. He took down all our particulars. He said, right, you can have a medical here and now, which we did. We both had our medicals, which we passed, through dentals and everything. We went back to see him again, and he said, right, your name's down. We'll let you know in as soon as we can when you'll be called up. But he said, there's only one snag. He said, at the moment, we've only got one lot of vacancies. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? We've only got one lot of vacancies, and that's in the medical branch. He said, I'll have to put you down as sick berth attendants. But he said, don't worry. When you get to joining up station, which will probably be Skegness, because that's where the main people for joining the Navy went, he said, the first thing you do is ask to change your rate. He said, if you want to be seamen, or stokers, or engine room mechanics, he said, when you get there, you can say, I've want to change rates. He said, no trouble at all. So we accepted him at his face value, and we left it like that.
Did you not want to be a sick berth attendant?
Not particularly. It never really occurred to me. But we thought, well, let's get in the Navy anyway. And but what was strange, that joining up like that as volunteers, the Navy only had vacancies for in those branches. You'd think that you could get into the Navy and they'd wanted all sorts of branches, but it wasn't so then. Anyway, my friend Rodney Dove, we waited and waited, and then one day he rang up and said, we better go back to Croydon and just see what's happened. So we went back to the recruiting office and said to them, what is happening? This is now 2 months. I said, don't worry, don't worry, you'll get your papers in due course. So we left them again. About 6 weeks after that, Rodney rang me up and said, I've got my papers, have you got yours? I said, no. He said, well, I've got to go next Monday to Skegness. So I said, oh, well, perhaps I'll get my papers shortly. So I went back to Croydon. I said, Rodney has got his papers. He said, oh, he said, that's understandable. He said, they may have come through first. He said, you'll get yours, don't worry. Cheerful, flat happy. Navy Jack Jolly. And so I waited. Rodney joined up. I heard from him that he'd gone to Skegness, which was the training base. He'd asked for a transfer, and he'd been made into an ordinary seaman rating. So I thought, oh, that was the thing to do. And then I never heard from him again. Things went on and on. And it was more than 2 months later before I got called up. And I went to Skegness, and one of the first things I did was to say, can I transfer my rating? I've joined up as a sick berth attendant. Can I transfer to the seaman branch? Oh, no, you can't do that. Oh, you can't do that. You're a sick berth attendant. Sick berth attendant, you bloody well will be. And so I said, well, I was told all this. He said, if they tell you anything at the recruiting office... So on we went, did the fortnight's basic training, and I still started to say to people, they said, look, wait till you get to Chatham. When you finish the basic training here, you'll go to Chatham Barracks. He said, ask them there to change your rate. So I thought, well, there's nothing much else I can do, so I did that. At the end of the 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, I can't remember how long it is now, I went down to Chatham Barracks, a quite appalling place. And there I saw, quite coming out of the mist, if you like, was a naval padre. And I thought, ah, if you're in trouble, you go to the padre. So I just sort of said, excuse me, sir, I've got a problem. And he said, come along, he said, let's talk it over. So he just walked to one side, and I told him what the matter was. I wanted to swap. He said, you can't do that. He said, I'm afraid you'll have to do your training as an SBA. He said, and then we can see what had to be done. So I just sort of resigned myself to it and went up to the naval hospital near Chatham, which is at Gillingham, and was trained as a sick berth attendant, which, I must admit, it wasn't too bad.
What did it involve?
Well, strangely enough, it was really this training that I would think was given to a nurse. It was how to make beds, how to give medicines, how to give blanket baths. There was never any question of treating casualties, which I thought most odd, seeing as it was a war. But however, this was it. Then, after 6 weeks of that, we got our first draft chit, as it was called then, and I went up to Scotland to HMS Scotia, S-C-O-T-I-A, which was a telegraphist's training camp. And it had been a Butlin's holiday camp, unfinished when the war started, so the Navy had finished the construction and taken it over. And there I was in the sick quarters, literally looking after sick sailors, more or less as a nurse, which bored me completely. So I put in for a draft chit, which they were quite glad to give, and I was drafted from there to a destroyer, brand new destroyer, HMS Loyal, which was being built on the Clyde, and I went along to it about 3 weeks before it was launched, or taken over from the shipyard, and to my astonishment I found I was the only medical attendant, sick berth attendant, on the ship. There was no other. So there was me, never having been on a ship before, finding myself as the only medical attendant with masses of stores to unlock, undo, apportion out, and after about 2 days, when I was getting into a total muddle, along comes a surgeon lieutenant. And he said, oh, he said, are you the sick berth attendant? And I said, yes, sir, so I am. And he said, well, to tell you a secret, he said, this is my first ship. He said, quite true. He said, this is my first ship, so I need some help. I said, well, strangely enough, it's my first ship as well. So once we'd established that, we sorted things out, and we were the best of friends. And this was Surgeon Lieutenant Hall, his name was. Now, I didn't know it, but one of the duties of a Surgeon Lieutenant on a destroyer is to decode ciphers, secret ciphers. When they come through on the radio, they come through in the form of coding, and where they are marked secret, an officer has to decode them, and that was the Surgeon Lieutenant's job. The result was that my Surgeon Lieutenant was hardly ever in the sick bay, but he was up in the communications office decoding ciphers. So I found myself virtually alone on a destroyer in the sick bay as the only rating on board with any medical training whatsoever. And that's how I went actually to war. Now, the Loyal was a brand new destroyer, a very heavy destroyer. There was Lafori, Lookout, Loyal, Lightning and Lance was in the flotilla. We first of all went up to Scapa Flow for training with the fleet, and then we came back to Christmas, and this would be Christmas 1942, for a short spell of leave, and we returned on Christmas Eve 42, sailing on Christmas Day 42, to escort troop ships down to the North African landings, Algiers and Oran. And the rest of my time down there was in the Mediterranean, the rest of my time on a destroyer.
What do you remember about the North Africa landings?
Now, the North Africa landings, we were just too late for the original landings. They had been made, what was it called, Operation Torch, wasn't it? We were just too late to there, so we basically stood off the coast. But we used to go into Algiers Harbour, and then we would go up the coast a little place to a most beautiful little Arab town called Djeli, And then as things progressed, we based ourselves on Bone, a place which is now called Anabar, and that was our base for the Mediterranean at that time. And we went out there on forays looking for E-boats, U-boats, who were trying to reinforce the Africa Corps in North Africa. And on one of those occasions, very sadly, our co-destroyer, HMS Lightning, was sunk by an E-boat, and we had to rescue and take on board the majority of its crew, which we did.
What did you personally see?
What I personally saw, didn't see any of the action, because it was at night. All I heard was that we were picking up survivors, get ready for them. Now, there was just me, and I could turn the wardroom of the destroyer into a sick bay. The doctor came down, he said, look, you have to look out, do the best you can. He said, I've got other people up forward, I'll look after the injured, you look after the less injured. So we took on board all the Lightning's survivors, and as they came up over the ship's side, the ship's officers could see who was badly injured, or injured, or the ones lightly injured, and directed them either to me or to the doctor. Most of them, fortunately, were lightly injured or not injured at all. And they, of course, were dispersed round the ship to be looked after by the crew, warm blankets and dry clothes and things like that. But I had to look after, in the wardroom, something around 30 survivors in various stages of undress, because some of them had had their clothes blown off. But fortunately, there were no deaths actually on board. We picked up a few corpses and looked after them until we got back to Bone and Algiers, and then they went ashore.
When would it have been about?
That was March 1942, 43, March 43 that would be. It is recorded that, the sinking of the Lightning. But thereafterwards, on the destroyer.
Excuse me, harrowing was it for you dealing with those people?
Looking back on it, as I have on many occasions, it wasn't really harrowing. It was something that you've been waiting for, picking up people who were hurt. It wasn't harrowing in a way. You just did a job, which surprised me as I look back on it.
It just went off in a professional sort of way?
It just went off in a quite professional way. A lot of the fellows helped themselves, those survivors who came on board, who weren't hurt. Most of them were covered in fuel oil, and they used clothes and rags and blankets and anything they could to clean the fuel off themselves. But the thing that I was talking about later on with my medical officer was how ridiculous it was that I had been drafted to the sole occupation of the sick bay branch, never having been taught how to deal with casualties. I'd come straight from virtually a nursing home, which was the base sick bay in the training camp. Never having seen a casualty, I was suddenly put on to that position. And yet, strangely enough, I was able to cope. So what it was, instinct, I don't know. There was bandages, there was fellows with a broken leg or broken arm. And you put on a splint, and you put on a sling. And then when you got to Bone, to the base, other medical attendants came on board from the base and looked after the people and took them off. But it was strange that I was thought to myself, I'd never seen a man with a fuel oil burn until that. But somehow, he wiped it off him, and he put a bandage on. And it came off, and it worked all right. But it always occurred to me since that they should have trained seagoing medical staff in dealing with actual casualties, and not as if they were just sick people lying in a hospital bed.
What was the psychological state of the casualties?
Of the casualties, I don't really know. We only had them on board for a matter of hours, because this sinking took place not very far off the North African coast, and I doubt if they were on board more than 3 hours before we got back to harbour.
But did they seem to be calm?
They were calm.
Shaken,
they were shaken. They were calm. Mostly, I think they were quite overwhelmed by what had happened, because we'd been cruising along the North African coast for weeks and weeks, looking for E-boats, looking for submarines, and nothing had happened. And then all of a sudden, a torpedo had struck the Lightning. It sank in about 15 minutes, and they didn't really know what had happened to them. And I think the 3 hours or so that they were actually on Loyal, HMS Loyal, was recovering from the shock of what had happened to them. They hardly spoke a word, even amongst themselves. There was no sort of hear jolly jack and frivolity, as I remember. There was quietness, and the ships went back as fast as they could to the harbour and landed the casualties. Well, landed all the survivors, and then put up the rest of the crew to cleaning up the ship again, which was in a filthy state, mostly with fuel oil. That's really the basic of that. And then the next event that happened was when the Africa Corps yielded, and we were off Tunis then, and a mass of little boats came out from the shore with German soldiers on board, surrendering to us. And we picked them up, they came on board, they were searched, and put into a mess deck and taken to Malta as prisoners of war. But there again, they were most of them couldn't speak a word of English, and most of us couldn't speak a word of German, because in those days you didn't know very much about foreign languages.
Did any of them seem to be defiant?
I think they were very glad. No, none of them seemed to want to fight back. They were mostly very young boys, men, very young men. One, I remember, had the most appalling carbuncle on his left thigh, well, one of his thighs, the most appalling carbuncle, which we had to treat. And he was the only casualty among them that we had to look after. But after that, we went up into Malta and had a short rest in readiness for the invasion of Sicily. And when that came off, we took part of the escorting fleet, invaded Sicily. Again, I can't remember anything momentous happening. And then as the things went up to Italy, as the events moved northwards, the next thing was the Salerno landings. And there we did have a bit of trouble, because we were hit from a shell fired from a tank on shore, and the shell, very fortunately, did not explode. It went into the side of the ship and careered around inside one of the boiler rooms and just dropped on the deck and didn't explode, fortunately. But we were taken out of service just for a moment while the hole was patched up, and then we laid smoke screens off the coast of Salerno while the main landings for the barges took place. Now, just after that, we went up to have a short rest at a very